Hey there, this is Patrick. Just wanted to draw your attention to one thing before episode 14 starts here. Our sit-down guest for this month is Dr. Stephen Pipe, the pediatric hematologist out of the University of Michigan, who is also the chair of the National Hemophilia Foundation's Medical and Scientific Advisory Council. At the time that Natalie and I recorded our segments for this podcast, we didn't have Dr. Pipe as our guest yet. We didn't know who our guest would be. It's as though there wasn't a guest at all. So you're not going to hear us mention Dr. Pipe, and I just wanted to let you know that now because he provides some excellent insight in this episode into some of the products that are currently in clinical trials that have quite the promise for our community in both the non-factor replacement therapy category and the gene therapy category. So a worthwhile, dense interview worth listening to that you're not going to hear about for a little while. So just before the episode kicked off, wanted to let you know, stay tuned because there's a great interview coming up in this episode, even if Natalie and I don't talk about it. All right, here we go. Hey, Natalie.
Hey, Patrick.
Do you know who makes the Bloodstream podcast possible?
Andrew Gull.
True. His editing prowess is what allows this to come out every month, but not exactly who I had in mind. Do you know who makes the Bloodstream podcast possible?
Me?
Well, yeah, as the co-host, you do have a significant role to play with it actually coming to fruition. But Natalie, do you know who makes the Bloodstream podcast possible?
Are you talking about Shire?
That's right. Shire makes the Bloodstream podcast possible. And we thank them for enabling us to produce this engaging and educational new media piece of content. And we look forward to continuing to grow the podcast with their support.
So, thank you, Shire.
Oh, very good. Thank you, Shire. You knew that partner. Thank you, Shire. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 14, July 17th, 2017. I'm Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, a member of the bleeding disorders community shares her take on platelet disorders, what they are, how they're treated, and what they're like to live with. Natalie will lead a discussion on a recent New York Times health article that states CDC studies have determined opioid use in the U.S. has actually been on the decline since a 2010 peak. Why is that significant, and what does it mean for our community? And Natalie and I are going to play a little game centered around a relatively new online platform for the community that perhaps you're not yet aware of. All of that plus updates on healthcare, conferences, and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. It's on you, kid. Yeah, good start.
You always make me nervous.
Well, you know, it's you got to be ready for the pressure. This is okay. A high-stakes podcast.
I'm ready.
All right, well, you're on.
So last weekend, I infused Chris Bombardier. How'd that make you feel?
Hey, come on, you got to give him a little more background than that. Why was that significant?
Because you've been a fraidy cat.
All right, so I'll explain it. So Natalie's been asking to infuse me for quite some time. And last weekend, Chris Bombardier and his wife Jessica were out here. We were looking over some footage from the Bombardier Blood documentary that we're working on about his summit of Mount Everest. And, you know, Chris hates needles and hates infusing himself, and just and Jess does it a lot for him because it really, like, genuinely makes him anxious. So Natalie asked, or I forget, did he offer or what? How
well,
did that
no,
go down?
I asked Jess if she infuses Chris, and she was like, yeah, all the time. And then she was like, have you infused Patrick? And I said, no.
I'm forbidden from it.
I've wanted to since I met him, and I've gotten the stern no many times. And she was shocked by that, and Chris was shocked by that.
Why were they shocked by that?
I think most partners of someone in the community have had the opportunity to do that because it's safety. I don't know. I think most people would want to know that, like, the person who spends the most amount of time with them is capable.
Here's the thing.
And has done it before. I know I'm, like, capable of anything. And so maybe that's why you're just like, okay, in an emergent situation.
That is how I feel.
I just think Natalie would be able to
pull
this off.
That is how I feel. It's true. I mean, I understand that, like, practice is useful. But I just don't, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. And I feel like if I was, like, concussed and out cold, like, you would just step up.
I would
up
just make it
and
happen.
And I wouldn't even need to participate. I'd just wake up and you'd be like, hey, you passed out. I infused you. Everything's great. And I'd be like, oh, cool. Great. All right. Next time I pass out, feel free to do that again. But in the meantime, like, I'm really ready.
I think that's brave. I mean, I've been calling you a fraidy cat, but the fact that you're just, like, totally cool with passing out and knowing that, like, I could properly do it without further damaging you.
Or at least hoping. I don't know about knowing, but yeah. So here's another thing. We did talk. Natalie does. She's really like chomping at the bit to infuse me. And I do recognize that her points are valid and that your partner should know what to do. That's a useful thing. So we are going to do that sooner than later. She wanted to do it on the podcast today. I said, if we're going to do that, we got to also video it because I don't know what that's going to look like. And that could be a lot of fun. So we haven't done that yet. Maybe for the next episode and we'll have some video on the website. We'll figure that out. But your turn is coming up. And yes, Chris will forever be the first man you infused. And I just have to learn to live with that. But I will be the second and the everlasting.
That's true.
All right. I can accept that. That's good enough for me. And now for a little bit of housekeeping, the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis, also known as ISTH, their 2017 Congress taking place in Berlin, July 8th through the 13th, Berlin, Germany, that is. We are recording this podcast on July 8th, so unfortunately we're not going to have the benefit of knowing what the big stories, press releases, therapeutic updates are coming out of ISTH. For this episode. So what we've done is we have somebody on our team who is keeping an eye out this week for anything that's coming out of ISTH that we believe is relevant, useful, and of interest to the bleeding disorders community. So by the time you're hearing this, if you look at the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com under episode 14, you'll see the headlines and hyperlinks to all the relevant pieces of information that came out of the conference for our community as best as we can determine. So I'd encourage you to check those out, and apologies that we couldn't provide you a little more information about ISTH here on the pod itself. I was hoping to be there, but unfortunately some changes to my schedule dictated that I was not. So check out those updates in the program notes. Likewise, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, the Senate healthcare bill that has been the hottest topic probably in the country, well, not even just in our community, but in the country in the past number of weeks. We, again, are recording this on July 8th, so not going to get into kind of granular updates on where we're at, because by the time you're hearing this, it's probably changed. In general, right now, we're in good shape. We have enough senators who are showing opposition to the bill to prevent it from passing, but we're not out of the weeds yet. So please continue all of your advocacy efforts to ensure that your senators are saying no to this bill. And a shout out to the Hemophilia Federation of America, the National Hemophilia Foundation, and all of the chapters and organizations and individuals around the country who have been such tremendous vocal advocates during this battle. It has been impressive to see the amount of advocacy energy around our community. We do have a podcast that we recorded with HFA's Director of Policy and Government Relations, Katie Verb, where we talked about advocacy and defeating the BCRA. You can find that on the Ask the Expert podcast series. So if you go to Bloodstream Media and check out Ask the Expert podcast, give a listen to that podcast with Katie. She gives some really interesting information on kind of how government and legislation works in general and how this process and this bill are kind of specifically head-scratching. Likewise, we have another new podcast through our Powering Through podcast series, and that one features NFL Super Bowl champ and community member Josh Gordy and cross-country cyclist Barry Hardy, two very impressive athletes who you can hear speak about obstacles, challenges, and what it takes to overcome on the Powering Through podcast, which you can also find at bloodstreammedia.com. And a reminder to subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast, Ask the Expert podcast, and the Powering Through podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you have any feedback for us, we're always interested in hearing from you. You can email us, info@bloodstreammedia.com, fire off a tweet to @bloodstreaminfo, or post to our Facebook wall, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia. And now just two announcements before we get into the like, share, comment segments for this month. Believe Limited, Bloodstream's parent company, is going to have a presence at a few different events this summer that I want to make you aware of. July 14th and 15th, which just passed by the time you're hearing this, we were in Cedar Rapids, Iowa to produce a Powering Through session as part of Hemophilia of Iowa's annual meeting. July 28th and 9th, we're in Boise, Idaho to put on a Powering Through session and a Stop the Bleeding teen workshop for the Idaho chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation. August 4th and 5th, we'll be in the Woodlands, Texas, to produce a Powering Through session and a Stop the Bleeding Teen workshop for the Texas Bleeding Disorders Conference. And August 24th through 27th, we will be in Chicago, Illinois, for National Hemophilia Foundation's annual meeting, where we'll be putting on a Powering Through session, the Teen Impact Awards, and participating in a breakfast symposium on behalf of Bombardier Blood, the documentary about Chris's historic climb of Mount Everest. And Natalie, you also have an exciting responsibility at NHF's annual meeting as well.
Yes, Friday, August 25th, I will be teaching two yoga classes for the Healthy Steps program, one in the morning and one in the evening.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
It'll be an accessible class, all levels. So I encourage anyone, whether you've done yoga or you've been scared to try it, to come. It'll be a great class.
You know, I was just going to say, you've never taught a whole bunch of bleeders before, but that's not true. We did have you did run a session for a group of kids out here when we
did
a Stop the Bleeding workshop a couple years ago.
Yeah. So kids are welcome. Adults are welcome. Anyone's welcome. So
all right.
It'll be a good class.
So we'll see you there. And speaking of annual meeting, last announcement, next month's episode of the Bloodstream podcast will feature a segment previewing the meeting. You're going to hear from NHF CEO Val Bias, along with members of the NHF team, on what the 2017 meeting has in store, what's new, and what you should be paying special attention to. So that'll be on episode 15 of the Bloodstream podcast, coming out on Monday, August 21st. All right, that does it for the business. Now let's get on to the like, share, comment segments for this month.
So this month, for the like section.
Segment. We usually go with segment. You can say section.
Section, segment.
Yeah, words matter, Natalie. Words matter.
They do matter.
Okay. Go ahead, like segment.
For the like segment this month, I found an interesting article in the New York Times health section. Mm-hmm. It was written on July 6th, titled Opioid Prescriptions Fall After the 2010 Peak. The CDC had a report following trends of opioid use from 2010 to 2015. And there was a decline of 41% since 2010, which is great.
It's a big decline, too.
It is a big decline. But keeping that in mind, in 2015, it was still three times higher than the prescription rate in 1999.
So, in 1999?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
So even though there's a pretty decent decline, we're still three times.
We just peaked so high.
We peaked very, very high.
Right. If you actually like zoom out of the graph, we're still in a troublesome place.
Yeah. So,
okay.
I mean, it's good news, but it's also like we still need a pulse on this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's and now are there areas too? Does it mention where it's not necessarily on the decline, but maybe even on the rise?
So even though it dropped in 23% of counties, there was actually an increase.
And that's a lot, too. That's a quarter of counties. That's nationwide?
That's nationwide. And, I mean, it goes through saying that there were certain counties that they weren't able to collect data from. But out of the ones that they were able to collect, 23% of them had an increase. Hmm. So then the other had a greater decrease to balance
right.
that out for an overall decrease, obviously. And, you know, Dr. Ann Suchat, she's the acting director of the CDC. She said, despite the decline, we still have too many people getting medicine at too high of a level for too long.
Mm.
So, and it goes back to the clinic climate, where some of these counties are located and how
right.
fast and loose those doctors are with a pen.
And is there any common trends in these counties where it is still on the rise, or just opioid users in general? Like, do we have any kind of demographic information?
It's interesting. They said that larger amounts of opioids were prescribed in micropolitan counties, which I had never heard that term.
Yeah.
Interesting term. It's a county which has an urban cluster of 10,000 to 50,000 people.
Okay.
And then they call them anchor communities for larger rural areas.
Like they kind of work hand in hand with the sprawl outside of them, essentially?
Yeah. So it's these counties that are holding a lot of people, and then the surrounding counties tend to be pretty rural. They found that larger amounts were prescribed in counties with higher prevalence of diabetes and arthritis. You know, maybe conditions where there is a chronic pain
element to it, for sure. Yeah,
absolutely. And with larger white populations, higher unemployment and higher Medicaid enrollment. So those were some of the findings they had in the counties where, there was a larger, amount of prescriptions.
You were mentioning to me after you had read this that like one of your takeaways was that it kind of left you with a sense of hope. Can you say a little more about that?
The fact that overall numbers are coming down, even though they're still staggeringly high, it means that some of the tactics that we've put in place, tightening prescriptions, access to them,
forms of pain management.
Yeah, and it does give me hope. They did say that another way, and outside of just tightening the guidelines around prescribing, is that insurance companies could take alternative treatments and make them more accessible, cover them, pain management techniques, not techniques, but
Things like meditation, acupuncture, massage therapy,
physical therapy,
often not covered.
Yeah. Or very limited you know, coverage, you get 5 visits.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, if I have an issue, 5 visits,
if I have
is
a chronic
like...
pain issue, 5 visits is not doing much.
No. Yeah. So, you know, they definitely could change that. And that could be another thing to help this epidemic.
Interesting. So then I guess just to put this to bed, why do you think this is particularly important information for the bleeding disorders community?
Well, chronic pain is prevalent in this community. And I think awareness around safety, you know, opioids are helpful in some cases, and sometimes pain is so great that you need to use these, but knowing the right amount and for how long, and making sure that you're with a doctor who is mindful and that you're mindful and educated.
We'll have a link to the article in the program notes in your podcast player and on bloodstreampod.com if you would like to give the article a read yourself. Natalie, thank you for presenting that today.
My pleasure.
This month's Share segment is brought to us by Kira Bechet. Kira is a community member living in Colorado, who's actually a contributor to our 3-episode Bloodline series on von Willebrand disease, which you should totally check out at bloodstreammedia.com if you haven't already. But Kira also lives with a platelet disorder, which came up during our conversations for that Bloodline series. Platelet disorders are not something I know much about, so I asked Kira if she'd contribute a Share piece for this episode that describes what platelet disorders are, how they're treated, and what they are like to live with. Just to be explicit, Kira is a patient living with a platelet disorder. She is not a clinician or researcher or a clinical expert of some kind, so her definition and her perspective are, in fact, her own. So this episode's Share segment is Kira's piece on platelet disorders, read by a professional voiceover actor. Let's take a listen.
Platelets are a vital element in blood clotting. They're responsible for the formation of a platelet plug, which is used as a gummy substance for factors to cling to in order to complete a clot. Platelet disorders can be complex and, if not treated, they can lead to abnormal bleeding and bruising. Platelet disorders can be classified into 2 different categories: qualitative platelet disorders, meaning platelet function is abnormal, or quantitative, meaning that an individual does not produce the appropriate number of platelets. Severity of platelet disorders can range from mild to severe. Mucosal bleeds, such as nosebleeds, gum bleeds, GI bleeds, and heavy periods, are the most common signs of compromised platelet function. Living with a platelet disorder can be tough. Unfortunately, there is very little known about some of the most complex types of platelet disorders. Oftentimes, this leads to misdiagnosis, inadequate treatment, and an overall compromise of one's quality of life. Unlike other bleeding disorders, there is very little research that is conducted on the different types of platelet abnormalities. This lack of research plays a major role in the inequities of treatments for platelet disorders in comparison to other types of bleeding disorders. Many patients are given a vague diagnosis, usually as a result of lack of knowledge as to why one's platelets or platelet counts are abnormal. Overall, there is less advocacy and awareness for platelet disorders. As a patient living with a platelet disorder, it can be hard to know where you fit in with the bleeding disorders community. Oftentimes, individuals feel like they don't fit in with those with hemophilia or von Willebrand's disease. It's important to raise awareness of platelet disorders within our community in order to make patients that feel like outsiders feel welcome, and to come together as united front to continue to progress forward toward advancements in treatment and care for all individuals with bleeding disorders.
Thank you, Kira, for contributing this month's Share piece on platelet disorders. If you would like to give a read to the transcript from Kira's piece, you can find it in the program notes for this episode. Yes, so now for this month's comment segment.
Section.
No. No. The comments segment. So Natalie doesn't know what we're doing yet, so she's looking at me like a little nervous and a little like, what's going on? So what I want to do is Believe Limited has a platform that we started earlier this year called Bloodfeed. Maybe you've seen it, maybe not. There's a website, there's a Facebook page, there's a Twitter account, there's an Instagram account. And basically, it is our version of a bleeding disorders BuzzFeed, where we're sharing pieces of content that are intended to engage you through a laugh, through a funny take on something, through a funny cartoon that embodies an experience many of us have. It's real easy, digestible stuff. And what I'd like to do is, we do a lot of memes through BloodFeed. So I'm going to read some of the text from these memes, and Natalie, what you're going to do, because this is an audio experience, is you're going to describe for people the image of the meme that I'm reading the words to.
As a guess, or I'm going to look at it and actually describe it?
Oh, I didn't even think about the part where you could guess. Okay. All right, let's try this one as a guess. Let's see how this works. It's going to be the 15-minute comment segment. All right, so here's the first meme, Natalie, and you're going to have to guess what's going on in the image. What I tell people happened to me after I jog a bit and don't ice down after.
I was hit by a car, like a picture of someone just like whacked by a car.
How do you know that? That's correct. Did you guess that or did you see that?
No, because that's what you look like sometimes.
That's what I've said. That's what I said earlier. I shared that on Facebook and I was like, this is me after basketball in real life.
Yeah.
All right. That's funny that you guessed that correctly because I'm like that. That's interesting. Oh, this is going to be a tough one. Okay. I believe in you. Me, when someone says only men can have hemophilia.
Like, sort of, not disgusted look, but like, are you serious look?
Yeah, from a human?
Well, because you said from a human, I'm going to say no.
Correct.
From a baby. I mean, well, no. Baby is a human.
But. No, yeah, that is true. A baby is it. You're a doula. You should know this. Babies are humans, Natalie.
I mean, a human baby.
No, it's this dog that looks a little like our friend Kara. Just looking all like wise picture, yeah. And like a little like almost like an old matriarch just turning and being like, excuse me?
Yeah.
All right. So that's that one. All right. I'm still impressed that you got the first one. Now, this is a good, this is an important segment. Okay. Beauty and the Bleed. Beauty and the Bleed. This one's not so much a meme as a title for something.
Okay. I mean, obviously a play on Beauty and the Beast.
Very good. Your Disney knowledge is
on par. Yeah. Okay.
And so it's a photograph of Belle starting to infuse the beast. She says, just hold still. And he's saying, that hurts, and pulling away. He's like me. He doesn't want to be infused by her.
But I mean, that's like the scene where like he has the wound and she's helping him.
Yeah. We just arted over
so
that. Yeah. Lots of good stuff going on. All right. So one more. Let's see what we can find here. Let me find a good one. I want to end on a strong note. Okay, here's this one. Are you ready? This is the last one.
I'm ready.
I'm still impressed that you nailed the first one. Mom, every time she sees you hanging with friends at a chapter meeting.
It's definitely a meme that moves.
Okay, it's not.
Oh.
Yeah, so definitely not. But what else?
Well, if I was designing it, it would be a meme that moves and kind of like the move you just made, like a cute little shrug smile.
Oh, cute little shrug smile. No, it is a Golden State Warriors fan sobbing uncontrollably while taking what is guaranteed to be a horrific picture on his very tiny little camera. I don't know what's going on the court. It seems as, I mean, I don't even really want to imagine the level of tears that this guy is having is kind of intense. However, it does seem like a very appropriate photo for that caption. So why are we doing this silly little game? Bloodfeed is putting out a lot of interesting, fun content like what we just read, which is relatable and easy and fun. It's good stuff to share and share with friends. Like I was just talking about sharing the one that Natalie nailed because it really is the way I am like after a basketball game. But we also have shared some stuff on historical figures with hemophilia, tips for parents, advocacy action alerts, and more. So if you don't know about BloodFeed, I would just ask you to take 5 minutes. You can go to bloodfeed.com and scroll around, click around. But facebook.com/bloodfeed, or just look up BloodFeed, one word, on Facebook, and you'll find our page. It's a good page just for fun, easy ways to engage with bleeding disorders. If you're a parent with a kid, you know, it's a fun way to kind of show them content that can make them smile or laugh about their bleeding disorder, which sometimes is really, really necessary. So check it out, BloodFeed. We're proud of it. Hey, Natalie.
Hey, Patrick.
Do you know who the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by?
Ryan Gielen?
Well, yeah, in a way. He is one of the producers and co-founders of Believe Limited, so he gets some credit. Not exactly what I had in mind, though. Do you know who the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by?
Colby Crowe.
She has a lot to do with it. She makes sure that the episodes go up on Libsyn and are populated on the website and distributed effectively. We appreciate the work that she does. However, that's not exactly what I meant. Do you know who the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by?
You're talking about Shire.
That's right. Look at you getting it on the third try. Yeah, the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Shire. Without them, we wouldn't be able to provide you, our listeners, with this entertaining, educational, and engaging content for the bleeding disorders community. And so we say...
Thank you, Shire.
Thank you, Shire. And now for the episode 14 sit-down segment this month featuring Dr. Stephen Pipe. Dr. Pipe is a pediatric hematologist who heads the Pediatric Hemophilia and Coagulation Disorders Program at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's also the chair of the National Hemophilia Foundation's Medical and Scientific Advisory Council, or MASAC, which is the body of NHF responsible for, at this point, over 400 communications pertaining to medical issues, treatment guidelines, safety and efficacy concerns, etc. Dr. Pipe just returned from ISTH, and as is often the case at these major hematology conferences, updated data from ongoing clinical trials of products intended to treat people with hemophilia were presented at ISTH. I asked Dr. Pipe to give us some insight into what from these updates of these new products, particularly these non-factor replacement therapies and gene therapies, this brand new world that we're about to enter into in our community, what stood out to him? What is he looking for as these studies continue toward their endpoints? And when might we expect to see some of these products in our lives? And what will that mean? He addresses all of that and more in this segment. So here it is, episode 14 sit-down segment featuring Dr. Stephen Pipe. All right, Dr. Pipe, thank you very much for coming on the Bloodstream podcast. Much appreciated.
Sure.
So you just got back from ISTH, very big conference, especially for clinicians, scientists, and researchers. New therapies, clinical trials, the evolving pipeline in our community is a huge topic right now. Can you just give a little, just to kick off, can you give us a little perspective on why this particular period in time is of interest to our community when it comes to therapies?
Well, I think what you're going to hear from a lot of people related to this topic is what they're calling a real paradigm shift in therapies. You know, the foundation of treatment for hemophilia has been replacement therapy for the last 50 years. And the biggest inflection point we had after the initial availability of, you know, factor 8 and factor 9 is the real concerted effort to prophylaxis. And that's really made the biggest difference on health outcomes in hemophilia around the world, and particularly in the first world. We've had some incremental advances in the last few years, I would say mostly to... by improving the pharmacokinetics of the available factors. This has just given some additional tools for the treaters and for patients to try to reduce the burden of the replacement therapy and also maybe get even a better handle on reducing breakthrough bleeding. But where we're on the cusp of is a completely different way of thinking about treatment for hemophilia. So there really isn't a single category because the mechanisms of action here are quite different. One of the major lines of investigation is the use of a bispecific antibody called emicizumab. This was previously known as ACE910. And this is a factor 8A mimetic. And what I'm meaning by that is one of the fundamental roles for factor 8 is to help factor 9A and factor 10 assemble on the platelet surface to drive clotting. And in that role, factor 8 really acts like a scaffold. And when factor 8's not present, that reaction is incredibly impaired, and this is the primary defect in hemophilia A. The idea was to use the strength of technology of monoclonal antibodies, and a monoclonal antibody was designed so that one arm of the antibody recognizes factor 9A and the other arm recognizes factor 10. In a sense, what it's doing is it's replacing that scaffold function of activated factor 8. How this is an advantage for patients is, for one, since we're no longer replacing the factor 8 molecule, we don't have to worry about inducing inhibitors in patients who are at risk for inhibitors. Secondly, if you already have an inhibitor to factor 8, this antibody is not going to be impaired in any of its action. So the first time we have a treatment that it doesn't matter if it's given as replacement therapy when you don't have an inhibitor or even in the presence of an inhibitor. And the third major advantage of this molecule is because it's a monoclonal antibody, it's highly bioavailability when given as a subcutaneous delivery instead of an intravenous delivery. And then the final piece is antibodies in general have a very long half-life in circulation. And so this product is showing in the late phase trials that it's providing durable bleed protection for patients with inhibitors, patients without inhibitors, via subcutaneous delivery, as infrequently as once a week to even once a month, which is being evaluated in the last phase of these trials. And what was exciting at this meeting is we saw the top-line data for the pivotal trial in individuals with hemophilia A and inhibitors who were receiving emicizumab. And it was really remarkable, the data. Coincident with the presentation at the meeting, the publication was available in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what they did in that study, which was called Haven 1, they looked at patients who were previously with inhibitors being treated with bypassing agents, who were just taking bypassing agents on demand when they bled, and then they randomized them to either receive emicizumab prophylaxis or to continue on with their bypassing activity on demand. And what they observed was an 87% reduction in treated bleeds with the emicizumab prophylaxis. And maybe even more importantly, they examined the percent of patients who experienced zero bleeds over the course of the study. And 63% of the patients on emicizumab had zero bleeds. And I think these kinds of results we've just not seen with any other intervention in adolescents and adults who have inhibitors. There was another group who came into the trial already on prophylaxis with bypassing agents, and they were also transitioned to emicizumab prophylaxis. So now we have an opportunity to compare before they were on emicizumab and after, both in a prophylactic setting. And again, we saw an almost 80% reduction in treated bleeds when transitioning to emicizumab. And in their secondary endpoints, looking at all bleeds, joint bleeds, spontaneous bleeds, target joint bleeds, overall 80 to 95% reduction in those bleeding events. So as this study was being presented, I think people were really excited about these results, and really hoping that this will continue to move forward in the regulatory path. Now, as with all things, you know, these studies also are not just evaluating efficacy, but they're also evaluating safety. And this trial was not without some significant high-profile safety concerns. So the idea of a bispecific antibody driving a coagulation reaction with very long half-life, people even going into this trial did have concerns about whether there would be any untoward effects like thrombotic events. As it turns out, there were five events over the course of the trial. Two were essentially a deep venous thrombosis complication, and three patients had an unusual complication, which is a thrombotic microangiopathy. This is an unusual type of sort of hyperclotability in the blood that can be marked by destruction of red cells and platelets. So as they examined these five events, they were trying to look for what was the commonality that was observed amongst these patients, because the vast majority of patients did not have these complications. And what seems to be a unifying theme across these five events is these patients were all being treated for some breakthrough bleeding in the course of the trial, and they were using bypassing therapy on top of the emicizumab. Now, lots of patients still had bleeds in the trial and treated without consequence with their bypassing agent of choice, whether that was FIBA or Nova 7. But when they dove deeper into the clinical scenario of these patients, what they noted is patients who were treated with high doses per day, more than 100 units per kilo per day, on average for more than 24 hours of treatment were the ones where this complication was seen. So that allowed them to introduce some risk mitigation strategy for the ongoing portion of the trial, and the recommendation was that doses of the bypassing agent should be reduced. And if possible, patients had a history of having a reasonable efficacy with Nova 7, it was suggested to maybe try Nova 7 instead of the activated prothrombin complex concentrate or FIBA. So we don't know the full extent of the follow-up since that risk mitigation strategy was introduced, but the anticipation is that hopefully this will be a reasonable approach to avoid this complication in the future. So that was really the first high-level event that was presented. The second one is we also have some interim data from the HAVEN 2 trial, which was for hemophilia A patients with inhibitors who were less than age 12. And the patients in this trial range from age 2 up to just less than age 12. And we only have data on 20 patients, these 20 patients had at least 12 weeks of follow-up over the course of the study. And I think what was really remarkable is there were no bleeding events in these 20 patients over that course of follow-up. There may have been one bleed that was treated, if I remember from the platform presentation, but essentially the rest of the patients experienced no bleeding. I think any of us who treat patients with inhibitors, this is a remarkable achievement for a prophylactic therapy. And importantly, in this population of patients, there were no thrombotic complications as well. Second platform presentation received considerable enthusiasm, we'll have to wait a little bit longer for the full results from this pediatric pivotal trial. But from what it sounds like, with the conclusion of these trials, they will have sufficient data to finish their filing with the FDA for review for possible commercialization for patients with inhibitors.
And between now and then, is there any particular data point or piece of information that you will be looking for as the trial proceeds?
Well, I think if I was a reviewer for this application, I would want to see clearly from the time they introduced the risk mitigation, has there been any additional subsequent thrombotic complications? And if not, then that would give the regulators, again, in my opinion, would give the regulators an opportunity to put some put that same risk mitigation strategy into the label to ensure when this is approved that clinicians and patients clearly understand, you know, the high efficacy that it potentially has, but also how to use it safely and hopefully avoid any further thrombotic complications. Now, I also think in a study of this size, we have to be careful and put things in perspective. There's no way in the course of a small clinical trial like this that you can accommodate every possible clinical scenario that a patient might encounter. So, for instance, none of these patients, as far as I'm aware from the presentation, went through any major surgery. You know, think like a hip replacement or a knee replacement, something along those lines. I'm not aware of any patients who had, you know, a major traumatic event. And thirdly, you know, we'd be concerned about things like sepsis and perhaps, you know, what's the role of indwelling catheters, et cetera. So I think when this product has the potential to expand to much larger swath of the population, I think due diligence going forward is important. And almost certainly this product's going to require some data collection in the post-marketing phase so that we can track how, what's happening in patients in a number of clinical scenarios.
And if things continue to proceed with emicizumab and the trials and the Haven trials as expected, when's a ballpark timeline for when we may see this product available in the United States?
Well, I think it was well known that the FDA had granted a sort of a rapid review status for this product, and I would imagine that would give an opportunity for hopefully a priority review. And, based on where this trial is currently, I think there's a good possibility that a review could be completed before the end of 2017.
So you mentioned at the beginning how for the last 50 years or so, factor replacement therapy has been the standard of care, and emicizumab is an example of a non-factor replacement therapy that is getting closer and closer to potentially entering the scene in a major way. Can you give us an overview of maybe a couple other non-factor replacement therapies or gene therapies that are being worked on that you are paying particular attention to?
Yeah, so the other series of presentations that I think were also very interesting is the work with fituzuran. So fituzuran is, again, a completely different way of thinking about treating hemophilia. So first let me just give an analogy to help people understand. So I want you to picture a teeter-totter. And on one side, you have the procoagulant. So this would include factor 8, factor 9, the things that are driving clotting. And then what's counterbalancing those procoagulants are natural anticoagulants. And there's three natural anticoagulant pathways that we know are of particular significance in controlling this clotting and bleeding balance. One is called tissue factor pathway inhibitor, or TFPI. The other one is antithrombin, and then the third one is protein C. And when you have a reduction in the procoagulants, the hemostatic balance is tipped towards bleeding because you have the full action of the natural anticoagulants and not enough procoagulants. So what we've been doing for 50 years is adding back in the procoagulants to try to bring the teeter-totter back into balance. But it's actually been known for some time that you can accomplish the same thing by not replacing the procoagulants, the clotting factors, but actually reducing the action of the natural anticoagulants. And how do we know that this is true? Well, we've known for some time that individuals who inherit so-called thrombophilic risk factors can actually moderate the clinical phenotype of severe hemophilia A. And in fact, there's some studies that have shown that if you have co-inherited something like protein C deficiency, or there's even some examples of co-inheriting antithrombin deficiency, that this improves the thrombin generation in these individuals, even though you haven't added back in any factor 8 or factor 9. I think we have some clinical, we already had some clinical experience to suggest that this is likely to work. So fitusiran uses a technology to knock down the synthesis and the protein levels in the blood of antithrombin. And it uses a technology that actually resulted in a Nobel Prize for the individuals who came up with this strategy. It uses what's called a small interfering RNA. So these RNAs are synthesized to target a very specific gene sequence. What they did is they modified this RNA so that it would specifically target to the liver. And they did that by adding essentially a sugar group onto the RNA so that it would be recognized by the scavenger receptors that are on the liver, which are sampling the plasma as it goes by. And this siRNA gets taken up by the cell, and it delivers this small interfering RNA to the nucleus. And what it does is it specifically seeks out the messenger RNA coming off the gene for antithrombin, and it assembles in a complex, which is called the RNA-induced suppression complex. And what it does is it actually ends up cleaving the message from antithrombin so that antithrombin deficiency goes down. Depending on the dose it's delivered, you can suppress the protein levels of antithrombin down to about 20% or less of normal. And so again, what that does is it changes the balance. And so now without giving any factor 8 or factor 9, you're allowing the teeter-totter to come into balance. And it may seem incredible to think that you could prevent bleeding without providing any factor 8 or factor 9 replacement, but that's exactly what the studies have shown. They showed a dose-dependent, durable suppression of antithrombin to down to about 20% of normal. Notably, this is also given subcutaneously. And in the study that was presented at ISTH, this was dosed as infrequently as monthly. And they showed what happens to the thrombin generation in these patients. And it turns out that, again, without replacing any factor 8 or factor 9, their thrombin generation starts to approach and even overlap with healthy controls who do not have hemophilia. And then the proof is really in the bleed control. And again, what the study showed is the patients who went on prophylaxis with this fitusiran were able to get durable bleed control with Q-monthly subcutaneous dosing. Individuals who came into this trial, their median annualized bleed rate was about 12 per year, if they were treated on demand. And a couple of patients were on prophylaxis and already had low bleeding rates, as you can imagine, with an annualized bleed rate of about 2. And both of those groups were followed with prophylaxis with fitusiran, stopping their regular replacement therapy. And the annualized bleed rate on fitusiran was 1.7. And that data I just gave you is for patients who had inhibitors. They also included individuals who didn't have an inhibitor. And this was a fairly heavy bleeding group that came into this. They were on-demand patients. Their annualized bleed rate before fitusiran was 38, and the median annualized bleed rate on fitusiran was remarkably 0. Now, there's a range in there, but the median, at least, was 0. So, again, very exciting data. Again, as we talked about with emicizumab, the study's also evaluating safety. So were there any safety issues in this trial? Well, there were no thromboembolic events in this study. and no clinical laboratory evidence of any pathologic clots formed. The treaters were instructed to reduce the use of bypassing agents or factor replacement while patients were on the trial. So they had already implemented a risk mitigation strategy was built into the trial. So that seems to be successful as far as preventing thrombotic events. What they did observe is they had several patients who developed a modest elevation in their liver enzymes. That got as high as about three times the upper limit of normal. They were completely asymptomatic. They were only picked up on laboratory assays. Most of the cases improved without any dose interruption. In one case, the patient did discontinue the drug. Not sure what the mechanism is causing this, although, again, looking for a unifying underlying factor in these patients, all the patients who had this liver enzyme elevation were positive for hepatitis C. So it's possible that this is somehow directly or indirectly related to their underlying hepatitis C status. So pretty remarkable study results. This paper also came out in the New England Journal the same day it was presented at the meeting. So two really paradigm-shifting therapies, top-line data from pivotal trials, and the expectation is for presumably a drive towards imminent regulatory review.
And just to cap off the Fitusiran, similar final questions as we discussed with emicizumab, are there any particular data points or anything that you are going to be keeping an eye out for as the study continues? And timeline, when might we, Fitusiran's in a different point in its progress than emicizumab, when might we see that product on the market?
I believe Fitusiran still has a phase 3 trial program or so-called pivotal trial program, which will continue to execute over the course of the second half of this year. So I would imagine that, you know, we're going to be well into 2018 before this may be approved. As far as what I would be looking for, I think, you know, people are interested in this transient elevation in the liver enzymes. You know, if it is true that this is limited to hepatitis C patients, I think we want to see over a larger population of patients if that's true, and then maybe try to understand what type of hepatitis C status, you know, was precipitating this. I don't believe any of these patients actually had active disease, you know, but we'll have to see if there's a particular subgroup of these patients who, you know, maybe this is going to have to be watched closely once they first start on the drug.
And moving from these two disruptive or breakout therapies to the gene therapy world, what in the gene therapy realm is of interest to you? What, any updates at ISTH that were of particular note, or anything that you've read that's particularly encouraging or indicative in some way?
Yes, we saw a number of again, top-line results from the gene therapy trials. Now, there's nothing really new that hadn't been previously presented at either the WFH meeting last summer or the at the ASH meeting this past December. But what we did get is sort of some additional sort of follow-up from the patients who reported in those trials. And I think, you know, the two programs that, you know, received the most attention with new results at the at ISTH was the SPARC study using a bioengineered AAV vector with a hyperactive factor 9, so-called Padua variant factor 9. And, you know, these subjects have now demonstrated that they've had durable expression of factor 9 now, factor 9 activity that's been somewhere between 20 to as high as, you know, approximately 75%. You know, so thinking back to what we were sort of expecting from the clinical trials with gene therapy. I think people were looking to convert patients from severe to maybe moderate or mild disease. But, you know, this program suggesting with a hyperactive form of factor 9, you can push patients so that they're approaching or actually in the normal range. The other trial that was had some additional follow-up study was the study from BioMarin, which is the only one that we have data for hemophilia A. This is, again, an adeno-associated virus, or AAV. It was a different serotype or viral coat, if you like. This was an AAV5 vector. But at the highest dose cohorts, again, remarkably, the majority of patients were within the normal range for factor 8, so above 50%, and a couple of patients actually got to supernormal levels, above 150%. No complications from expressing that high, but now what was presented at the meeting is that these patients have durable expression, and they're still still showing stable factor 8 levels in this curative range. So I think this has just really raised the bar for what people are anticipating from gene therapy. Now, these were all early phase studies, you know, phase one level data. Many of the companies are moving on to their phase three studies, both for factor 9 and for factor 8. And I'm just really excited going forward that, you know, this could be the, you know, the final transition that we've been looking for in hemophilia. And, you know, I think that the subjects that have been evaluated are all in adults. I think it'll be some time before we see a pediatric trial for gene therapy. But, you know, I think you've got real hope here that, you know, look, we're probably still going to do replacement therapy in our youngest patients. It's possible if they develop an inhibitor, you know, we may still do a trial of immune tolerance, but we're probably not going to do immune tolerance for years and years, you know, in a state of futility. When you've got potential therapies that will work for inhibitors and provide prophylactic, you know, bleed prevention, I think we won't continue with immune tolerance regimens indefinitely. And then maybe these therapies will, these emerging non-IV therapies will carry patients to adulthood, preserve their joints, and they will then have the option to consider gene therapy when they're an adult. And so what the paradigm shift here is it's not a complete abandonment of factor 8 or factor 9 replacement, but overcoming some of the major challenges that have been before us, being able to have an effective therapy for inhibitors, so that it wouldn't remain the scourge and the real cost to care that it has been for so many years, and therapies that are really cross-segment, if you like. Fituzuran, you know, it really doesn't matter whether you have factor 8 or factor 9 deficiency. It doesn't matter whether you have an inhibitor or not an inhibitor. In fact, you know, it hasn't been explored yet, but there's all the reason to think that this agent would work for any clotting factor deficiency. So what, think factor 7 deficiency, factor 10 deficiency, et cetera. And so maybe that will be explored, and maybe we've opened up an avenue to provide the kind of prophylactic therapy that's needed for some of these other rare brain disorders. So I think this has never been a more exciting time to be working in hemophilia, to see the fruits of really innovative research come all the way to the clinic and be executed successfully in these clinical trials. I just think is tremendously exciting.
I know I have to let you go, so just one more question. We've heard, again, you said it earlier, for 50 years, factor replacement therapy or replacement therapy has been the standard of care. In the last number of years, extended half-life products, still factor replacement therapy, but extended half-life products were kind of the big development and the big discussion amongst community in terms of new therapies. As we move into this potential, as you said, final transition, what is the role of factor going forward?
Well, you know, we didn't really talk about it yet, but, you know, there's a lot of things that we've got used to doing in managing patients with traditional fat replacement, which are not going to be available to us with these new agents. So the first thing is, you know, we have clinical correlates from a factor level and a clinical outcome. These new agents don't really give us the kind of clinical, like measurable laboratory tests that we're used to then provide the kind of clinical correlates that we've, you know, developed and learned over many, many years. And so that creates a little bit of anxiety and uncertainty in the treaters. You know, if you're trying to get someone set up for, you know, just think like a hip replacement surgery, how are we going to know with these new agents how to get them through that surgery? Have we given enough? Is the clotting action of these drugs really good enough to get the patient through those surgeries? What about a major trauma? What about a CNS bleed, a head bleed? I think there's a lot of things that we've learned to manage very well with factor replacement that we are going to be sort of starting from scratch, if you like, with these new agents. So I think we want to continue to make sure that we've got factor replacement for those times when we actually need it. I don't know that these agents have been fully evaluated with really intense peak activities. So think about, you know, the soccer player, the basketball player, or even the, you know, the older patient with hemophilia who wants to, you know, go on a camping trip with his grandkids. Is he going to be able to rely fully on these new therapies for those kinds of peak bleeding risk events? And I think we need to let that unfold. I think factor replacement is going to be with us for some time to come.
Well, thank you again for basically getting off the plane and being willing to take this call and provide this information. Really interesting stuff, and it's certainly an exciting time in our community. So thanks for helping provide perspective and helping us understand where exactly we are and what we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Looking forward to doing it again. Thank you, Dr. Pipe.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just before we wrap up our parting shots for episode 14, month of July, Natalie, what is your parting shot?
My parting shot is, I know I'm so late to hop on this train.
I can't wait.
But I just got into Game of Thrones.
Yeah, welcome aboard.
Super late. And I know it's coming back next week.
It is. Well, by the time people listen to it, it'll just come back.
Right. So, it's amazing. Yeah. And it took me a really, I was very reticent. I was very, but I'm on episode 3 of season 1.
Crushing it. Crushing it. You're going to catch up. You have plenty of time.
And it's the summer too. So that, you know, like I'm not trying to like stay inside and watch TV.
Right.
But like, I'm really excited of the journey ahead of me. So that's my parting shot. And if you are as late to the train as I am, there's still time.
There is still time. Good for you. Get on. We're reserving space for you, latecomer, right next to me, Natalie. All right, good. I'm excited that you're into it. That's fun. So my parting shot for this episode is a little bit of like a good news, bad news kind of situation. The good news is I've been doing a lot of flywheel spin classes since you got me into it, Natalie, which has been really good for my body. And I've been going pretty regularly now for the last couple few months. I don't know. And especially in the last 4 or 5 weeks, trying to go like 5 times, 6 times a week sometimes. And it's been really good for me. And it's cycling, so it's not big impact on the joints. It's a great cardiovascular workout. It's a great core workout. It's good for breathing. And my legs are stronger. It's a lot of good things. The bad news side is that I've been trying to play basketball a little more regularly in the last, actually this year. I've played more than I have in years past, and I'm not necessarily sure that that's in the cards for me for much longer, at least on like a competitive level, if at all. Coming home too many times looking like I got hit by a car, as we previously established, suggests that the cost is not worth bearing, and that's what I kind of keep saying to you. When I'm limping around for the days that follow, is like, I'm not willing to pay this price anymore. So that's kind of a bummer. Makes me a little bit sad, but I'm also appreciative that I've found this thing that I'm doing really well at. It's also competitive, and that fuels me. I like the competitive part of Flywheel, and they track your stats and where did you fall in the class and where do you fall in your area. Like, I like all that stuff. So I'm glad I found that, if in fact this is the beginning of the end of playing basketball competitively. So that's my parting shot. One more time, I want to give a big thank you to Shire for, again, making this episode and all episodes of the Bloodstream Podcast possible. Thank you, Shire. And that is all for this episode. Don't forget to check out bloodstreammedia.com and to subscribe to the Ask the Expert Powering Through Bloodline and the Bloodstream Podcast to hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community. Have a question for our Ask the Expert or an idea for a future episode of Bloodstream? Just want to say hi? Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. This episode of the Bloodstream Podcast was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie Lynch, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Avra Friedman, and Colby Crow. Special contribution from Kira Bachet, and the Bloodstream Podcast is edited by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, the Hemophilia Alliance, and Entertainment to Effect Change. Reminder, check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode, including our collection of news and stories coming out of ISTH 2017. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time,
take self-care of yourself.
Nicely done.